Well, actually, I was more of an early guy then. All right. Well, have you ever handled a hot potato? I mean, like, literally handled a hot potato. If you do, you've got to be quick. Beth, sometimes when she bakes potatoes, she wraps them in foil, you know, bakes them in the oven, and then she puts them in a basket. Well, real men take that potato out of the basket with their fingers and put it on their plate. Nothing with a fork and, you know, nothing like that. But then you got to unwrap that thing, but you got to be quick. And if you're quick enough, just like Joey handling his tortillas, apparently he was the only guy that never burned his fingers with tortilla because he was quick. You know, you could get by with it. And I wasn't going to tell you this, but we after years of this, I decided I'd come up with a little game. So you could wrap your foil up from your potato into a little ball, and you couldn't do it to the person next to you, but you could try to throw it in their glass of water and land it. And if somebody got you in your water, you had a chance to throw it back. So after dinner, you know, you'd have to go out and pick up all the little aluminum foil balls. You know, it's just a fun way of, you know, having lunch and doing something fun. But so have you ever handled a metaphorical hot potato? A troubling problem that no one wants to handle. Joey, apparently, you know, one of the hot potatoes at his father's tortilla factory was the hot tortillas, and he didn't like that job. So he liked, I think you said, putting the flour into the thing. So who likes to burn their hands? Who likes to work with a troubling problem that has a potential of burning you? Well, often a hot potato is used to describe a political issue, acts as a political book, and we're seeing this over and over again, especially in today's passage. Well, David Bahnsen, one of my favorite economic commentators, he has a segment every Monday called Money Beat on the world and everything in it. And in one of the podcasts recently, or I guess it's been a while now, he said that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, in dealing with raising the debt ceiling, said he had to play, quote, with a really, really hot potato. Something nobody wanted to deal with. And earlier in the segment, Nick Eicher, the host, made this correct observation. He said, quote, strictly speaking, this is not so much a debate, you know, the debate over the debt ceiling, a debate over economics. It's almost purely about political performance and policy choice, end of quote. I think that's a sad comment on the reality of our society today. It's sad that our political reality is that we cannot have a rational, national economic debate about the bad economics of continually raising the debt limit beyond what our generation is going to be able to pay. You would never do that. Well, people do. You don't want to pass your debt on to the next generation, which is what we're doing. Now, what I am trying to do with my sermon illustrations was driven home to me this week. Beth was listening to one of Al Mohler's podcasts. He's got Thinking in Public and then The Briefing. Except for 1 month in the summer, the briefing podcast is every morning. It's about 20 to 30 minutes every Monday through Friday. But he's got another one called Thinking in Public where he interviews writers of books. And he interviewed Amanda Ripley. She wrote this book called The Smartest Kids in the World. It was in 13 or 14. It just hit the New York Times bestsellers list and took off like crazy. I want to get this book. Beth is considering reading this for her ladies' book club. It was an interview by Amanda Ripley. And Joy, I think you're going to find this, Joy and Angie, this is very interesting. There are three factors that significantly helped kids score better on an international test. It's called the PISA test. PISA stands for Program for International Student Assessment. And she came up with three things in order, all right? It was good, and I think you all heard this one. It's good to read to your kids. That was your kids are going to be successful if you read to them. That's why, you know, it's so sad when we have all these broken families and everything. The second one is if the parent was even better, so it's not like you weren't supposed to do this, but even better, the parents read in front of the kids. Why? Because then they're showing the priority of reading and learning. Learning's fun. And number three, this is the kicker. The parents discussed current events and the news with their children. Why is that so important? Because you can know all the facts, but if you don't know how to turn those facts and live in the real world and reality, you're going to fail. You know, it's great. Oh, yeah, I know all the technology and transistors and everything, but it's the guys who make the most money and are really the smartest that know how to turn it into products like iPhones and cell phones. The PISA test is designed to assess how well students can apply their knowledge to real-life situations and then can therefore fully participate in society. And that's what I'm trying to do with my sermons. I'm not just here to spew out facts. Facts don't allow you to fully participate in society. How to take the facts of the gospel and apply them to what's going on in our society. Our society is falling apart. And I think evangelicals for years have just fallen flat on their faces in a lot of these areas. Well, we have a hot potato in our passage today. But our hot potato isn't a political idea. It's a person. Our passage today deals with a political hot Paul Tato. The Apostle Paul is too hot to handle. Well, please turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 23, verse 11. You might say, why am I saying verse 11 when the passage is verse 12? Well, we're going to start with verse 11 because that provides the context. And if you're using the Bible, it's in the seat. It's on page 1108. Page 1108. I'm going to read verse 11 because it provides an important context to today's passage. And really, it provides a verse kind of for the rest of Acts in one sense. 23:11 says, "The following night, the Lord stood by Paul and said, 'Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome.'" Do you see that word facts there? It's like, hey, in one sense, our job is to get facts, but Paul is using them to apply them to the gospel, and he is having real-world participation, and he's suffering for it. Jesus is expressing support for Paul, and he wants him to have confidence that Jesus is going to be with him. Jesus will never leave or forsake Paul, just like he will never leave or forsake us, even if the events of life don't make sense. So Paul is on his way to Rome. Well, today's episode begins the next day in verses 12 to 15, after that night. Verse 12 says, "And when it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near.'" So we have to review why Paul is so hated by the Jewish leadership. The Jews went nuts just a few days ago when he uttered the word, the evil word, Gentiles. Oh, so bad. Paul uttered the word Gentiles, and he wasn't speaking in a negative way. The way he spoke about Gentiles wasn't even all that positive. It's kind of neutral. He was just repeating what Jesus told him. That was one of the facts that Jesus told him to do, to go. He said, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." Well, Rome is kind of far away, and Rome is a place of Gentiles. So how racist can you get? The Jews put people into two categories. Think about this. Jews and everybody else. That's what's happening in our society today with a certain segment. Well, let's see what happens to the Jews' plot in verses 16 to 25. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." Yeah, these 40 guys aren't going to have much of a chance against 200 spearmen and 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen. The tribune knew how to take care of Paul, didn't he? So Paul hears of this plot, his nephew, and the tribune plans to protect him, to get him out of Jerusalem. That was one smart tribune. He sends him to Felix the governor. Now remember, we have to keep in the back of our minds that God is sending Paul to Rome. Paul knows he's going to Rome. He doesn't know how he's going to get there. But apparently there's going to be a delay. Now, what would you think been going on through your mind? You know, you're seeing Jesus the night before. He says, "Hey, I'm with you. You're going to go, you're going to testify me in Rome." You think, Paul's thinking, "Oh man, I'm out of here in the morning. I'm going to get on a ship and I'm going to go to Rome." Well, not exactly, big boy. You know, it's like, okay, God has a different plan. He's going to testify the facts about Jesus in Rome. Paul must trust in that. Why Caesarea? Well, there's lots of historical things. Well, that's where the governor was. So who is Felix? He's a Gentile. Paul is going to talk to him. Well, we're going to eventually get to there. But before we get there, Luke gives us some important information in the letter that the tribune sends to Felix in verses 25 to 30. And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them, when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." This letter is critical for understanding the importance and understanding the situation. First of all, let me comment that on the fact that Claudius Lysias writes about his involvement in the situation, and let's just say in a light, better light than what actually happened. Did you catch that? Felix is led to believe that the soldiers came to rescue Paul because he was a Roman citizen. And we know that he's at best stretching the truth. No. He didn't find out he was a Roman citizen until the tribune arrested him and then was about to flog him. He didn't tell the governor that part. That wouldn't have looked good. This is what happens in politics. You always try to put yourself in the best light by stretching the truth. And we do that. You don't have to be in a political situation to do that. You can be at work, you can be in your family. It's what we like to do. We like to make ourselves look better than we are, don't we? Well, second, the tribune's letter implicates himself as acting unjustly by his own words. He says in verse 29, "I found that he was being accused about questions about their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment." All right, so Paul is getting beaten. He's done nothing that deserves death or imprisonment. So why is he still a prisoner? Why didn't you let him go, Mr. Tribune, Mr. Claudius Lysias? Why? Because Paul is a political hot potato. The Jews had some political influence over this situation, and when you upset the Jews, they go nutso, so you got to be careful. Paul is a hot potato. Well, verses 31 to 35 tell us if Paul arrived safely in Caesarea or not. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So Paul does indeed arrive safely, and Felix is going to hear his case when his accusers arrive. Well, pull out your sermon note sheets at this point. This passage gives us, I think it should give us encouragement. Now, encouragement is also like encouragement, kind of like to do the right thing, encouragement. You know, Jesus encouraged Paul and says, "Hey, you've testified about the facts about me. Jerusalem, you're going to go to Rome." You know, that's kind of encouragement. Jesus is going to be with us. But I think the encouragement this morning is that we must trust God's sovereign control despite political injustice. Paul was treated unjustly. So injustice. One of these days we'll work to get the answers on the screen like when the other guy was here. I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to call Kevin you-know-who anymore. But thank you once again, Kevin, for doing the sound for us. Injustice. Trust God's sovereign control despite political injustice. This is the reality. Now, we can, in this broken world, we can minimize injustice, but we will never eliminate it. That is one of the realities of this broken world that we live in. Plato said, "The penalty that good men pay for not being interested in politics is to be governed by men worse than themselves." Plato, centuries ago, "The penalty that good men pay for not being interested in politics is to be governed by men worse than themselves." And I'm going to refrain on mentioning any, right now at this point, any people that we are being governed by right now. But I think you all can name a few names. So we've got three things that political injustice is caused by. Political injustice is caused by, number one, another race. Political injustice is caused by another race. Well, we all know this living in America. You know, we have the slavery by the blacks, There was a horrible blight on our country. So we all familiar with, you know, typically races. No matter what race you are, you know, Hispanics, and you know, they were caught, you know, being racist in LA against the black. I mean, it just happens. No matter who you are, no matter what race you are, your tendency is going to be towards your own race or ethnicity, or no matter what it is. I'm kind of using race as kind of a broad category here for just all kinds of things that we use to prejudice against each other. You know, we've got women prejudiced against men prejudiced against, you know, it just goes on and on. But political injustice is caused by another race. Paul is in a predicament because he just mentioned another race, the word Gentiles, and they went crazy. Paul, just a smidgen of friendliness by Paul to Gentiles is why he is in trouble. The Jews thought their main problem was the Romans, but their main problem was themselves. Which is a good segue. And by the way, that's why I read Luke 19:42. The Jews thought their way of to peace was to throw out the Romans. They would have killed every one of them if they could have. But Jesus said he had another peace in mind. You are not going to be at peace in this world unless you're at peace with God. And even if your race became the dominant one, you're not going to be at peace. It's going to be worse. And remember last week I talked about the difference between the North and the South, and by some of our government leaders who were on Abraham Lincoln's staff. They got turned over. They basically turned, one of them turned into an abolitionist when he crossed from North Carolina to South Carolina, when he saw all the poverty and everything. Slavery wasn't bringing all that, as great a prosperity as we're led to believe sometimes. It brought just, you know, when you have that mindset, when you're enslaving another human being, it's going to come out. And probably more on that later as I read my book called by Thomas Sowell. My favorite black rednecks and white liberals. But anyway, so number two, political injustice, and this is the biggest problem, is caused by your own race. As I mentioned, that this was the Jews' problem. They had more problems with their own race, inner fighting. Paul has done nothing worthy of death according to Jewish law, but they're out to kill him. And when you're driven by hate for another race, you're just going to act stupid. Just say it. Jason Riley said this. I would argue that on balance, and he's talking about, you know, the Black Lives Matter riots and all, and defunding the police and all that. So he goes, I would argue that on balance, these communities, talking about the black communities, are worse off. And by the way, Jason Riley is a black guy. He's on the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal and does some other things. He says, I would argue that on balance, these communities are worse off because by Black Lives Matter overemphasizing the role of police, they're changing police behavior for the worse. Then he says, the Manhattan Institute's Jason Riley told Fox News Digital in a phone interview, I'm reading from an article here, quote, in other words, police do become more cautious. They're less likely to get out of their cars and engage with people in the community. And to the extent that police are less proactive, the criminals have the run of the place. Riley noted that police brutality still exists. Bad cops exist. And he has no problem with raising awareness about police misconduct. But he argued that Black Lives Matter is, quote, over-focused, end quote, on police and does not take into account, and listen to this, 97 to 98% of all black homicides do not involve police at all. The black community has a problem within their own community. Are the police being brutal to whites? Yes. Are the police being brutal to blacks? Yes. Are the police, you know, you probably heard about that, those black I don't know how many of them, those black police officers that killed the black guy that they pulled over for a traffic stop in, I think it was Memphis, Tennessee. And last week I mentioned that Black Lives Matter still wants to defund the police. Now, do you think less police is going to mean more crime or less crime? Okay? It's going to be more crime. That's not a hard question, right? So, if there's more crime in the black community, is that going to lead to more black justice or less black, more injustice or less injustice? It's going to lead more homicide, more injustice. So, in a sense, the Black Lives Matter want more injustice on their own community by defunding the police. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't. But you're not going to make sense if there is so much hate in your heart. Paul was troubled by both sides. Did you get this? So he was like a Roman citizen and a Jew. He's like getting it from both. You know, here's the Roman guy, keep him in custody, even though he didn't do anything wrong, and the Jews are, you know, he's getting high by both races in that sense. I've said before that if you have a wrong philosophy, you are going to, it's going to break down at some point. And this happened just this week. I was reading an article. The black Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison went on a racially charged rant comparing Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to the iconic slave character in Quentin Tarantino's 2012 film, The Django Unchained. Well, I've never seen that movie. Ellison said Thomas's decision put him in line with the character Stephen, played by Samuel L. Jackson in The Django, I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that right, Unchained. In the film, Stephen is a sadist who remains loyal to his master. Ellison argued that Thomas's position on the high court is illegitimate and that he should be impeached. And then the lady who wrote this article, Jessica Chasmar, I don't know how to pronounce that either, she quotes Ellison, quote, he says, so, Clarence Thomas needs to be impeached, he continued. Clarence Thomas is illegitimate and has no basis in the job that he's in. And it's a lesson to us African Americans. What is the lesson? We all thought, well, he's a black man. He's raised in the Deep South. He knows what racism and segregation is. He knows what affirmative action is. He's going to come around one day. And then he says this. This is how she ends this article. It's brilliant because he implicates himself. Listen closely to this. Ellison says, understand that it's not a matter of pigment. It's not what's on your skin. It's what's in your mind. Did you get that? He just implicated himself. He's exactly right. He just argued that the pigment of your skin means you support affirmative action. You do things because of the pigment of your skin. He didn't argue that affirmative action was, you know, not according to the Constitution. He didn't argue that, you know, it's convenient to leave out the facts that affirmative action was used to be prejudiced and racist against Asians. No, he didn't mention that. I guess it's okay if you're a black guy, if you're getting the, you know, if racism is on your side. Ellison was right. It's not a matter of pigment. It's not what's on your skin. It's what's in your mind. Clarence Thomas didn't let the color of his skin color his judgment. Our last one, number three. Political injustice is caused by God. God is that. Who suffered the greatest amount of political injustice since the beginning of time? Jesus. God is responsible for the greatest act of injustice by giving up his son to political injustice. They killed him when he was innocent. But there is no other solution to man's problems. Man's sin is solved by the death and the resurrection of the sinless God-man. And that's the good news. That's hope. Jesus Christ. That's where we find our peace. Not in race or anything else of this world. Jesus is our example that we must and can trust God's sovereign control despite political injustice. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, as we come to your scripture and your word,